This is The Guardian.
Wenn man Leute fragt, was macht einen Investor aus, bekommt man oft diese Antworten. Investoren sind reich. Sie tragen teure Anzüge und haben Designertaschen. Sie waren Einserschüler und sind Mathe-Genies. Interessant, aber das stimmt so nicht ganz. Man muss weder reich noch Experte sein, um zu investieren. Mit iShares ETFs kannst du in Hunderte und Tausende von Unternehmen mit nur einem einfachen Schritt investieren. Schon ab einem Euro. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fang noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Now is the moment for Britain to choose its future. And we will have a general election on the 4th of July.
And as Big Ben strikes 10, the exit poll is predicting a Labour landslide.
Good afternoon. I have just returned from Buckingham Palace, where I accepted an invitation from His Majesty the King to form the next government of this great nation.
One general election, the decisive arrival of five-party politics, a new government, and a country that seems to be constantly on the verge of a breakdown. As the subject of an end-of-year retrospective, 2024 is surely a seasonal feast. So pull up a chair and get a very stiff drink. It's time to ask that very British question, what was all that about? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. Joining me today are who else but The Guardian's political editor, Pippa Creera, and The Guardian's political correspondent, Kieran Stacey. Hello and happy Christmas to you both.
Hi, hello. John. Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas.
Right, here's an obvious question to start. Do you like Christmas, Pippa?
I love it.
But do you?
I do, but my problem every year is that I'm so busy in the run-up to it, and everyone gets so stressed about, you know, not having ordered the turkey and not having bought the presents, that it's just sort of this mad dash to the end. And I kind of feel like I'm in the middle of it at the moment, not just sort of finishing off everything at work, but getting ready for 14 people invading from Scotland and all staying at our house. That'd be cozy.
Wow. Do they hang around till Hogmanay as well?
No. Well, I wouldn't say we're kicking them out. That's a bit rude about my own family, isn't it? But we suggested that they might like to stay 14. For 4 nights and then head back
wow,
up north.
14 for 4 nights.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Cozy. We'd get on very well. We'll be all right.
I hope you do. Kieran.
I love the fact that, John, instead of asking, what are you doing for Christmas, you ask, do you like Christmas?
It's a more revealing question.
I love it as well. I love it as well. But somehow, even though we are the bit of the family with the young children, we somehow always end up being the ones to traipse around the country at Christmas. So personally, I'm not looking forward to my journey up to Cumbria with two young children. But when we get there, it'll be lovely. Yeah, be really nice.
Do you want my answer?
Go on then, tell us.
Contrary to my somewhat Eeyore-ish Scrooge reputation... I actually like Christmas Day itself, and I like Christmas Eve, about 3 p.m, when you can feel it sort of coming on, the seasonal spirit. And I like Boxing Day. What does my head in is Christmas week and the endlessness of it. Like, what is this for? You know, when you get to the 29th and the world's still not turning and the news is still weird and all of that, I really hate it.
You'd have us all back at our desks,
like, wouldn't
you? 9 o'clock the next day.
The American model, they have 2 days in the States.
Yeah, but the American model, they've had another Christmas with Thanksgiving just a month before.
Well,
so they've all got
gout
in the end of December.
Maybe we can reveal here today that John Harris will be bringing you Politics Weekly Christmas. Politics Weekly Boxing Day.
I am actually writing a column Christmas week just to prove that I'm true to my word. Anyway, okay, so well, it's 2-1 to Christmas week. Right, let's talk about this febrile, strange, unpredictable year. Pippa, what was your moment, if you have to pick one, politically of 2024? Kick us off.
Well, it's really hard to choose from because there's so many. But if I had to settle on one, I would pick the Conservative Party manifesto launch in Silverstone.
Thank you. Well, good morning, everyone. It's great to be with you all and great to be here at Silverstone. Nowhere better, in fact, to mark the fact that our economy has truly turned a corner. Now,
And I say that not because there weren't many other, maybe even more symbolic moments. I mean, you'll all remember Rishi Sunak announcing the election in the pouring rain outside Downing Street.
Showing that when we work together, anything is possible.
As campaigners outside blasted, things can only get better through the gates. You'll all remember him holding an event at the Titanic in Belfast and everybody writing about sinking ships. You'll remember things like him coming home early from D-Day and saying that he had to go without Sky TV as a child.
So what sort of things had to be sacrificed?
Lots of things, right?
Can you give me an example?
All sorts of things. So like lots of people. There'll be all sorts of things that I would have wanted as a kid that I couldn't have, right? Mm-hmm. Famously, Sky TV.
Okay. And indeed, you'll remember the election betting scandal. But the reason I picked this one is because it was not just symbolic. It was actually quite a lot of weight to it as well. Now, the vast majority of the population don't generally notice manifesto launches, but they're really important moments because they're moments for us on the, you know, the Westminster beat to take the temperature of how a party's feeling.
Yeah.
And the very fact that this was held at Silverstone, I mean, it opened up them up to all sorts of metaphors, you know, going round in circles and car crashes. And of course, we all deployed them because why not? But just the mood in the room when the, first of all, you know, we first arrived in this big room, you couldn't even see the racetrack from it. The cabinet all came in with these sort of fixed grins on their faces, like trying to look buoyant, even though we already all knew that it was over for them. And then Sunak came in and gave this speech, which was sort of full of promises. You know, we all knew that he wasn't going to be able to deliver, wasn't going to be around to deliver, and sort of glossed over a lot of what had happened, barely mentioned what had happened in the previous 14 years, and talked about how the country could get better. And you're like, well, what have you been doing up until this point?
I'm fascinated about what you and other political journalists sort of feel in a situation like that, because you're in the midst of something which is completely absurd. Yeah. It's a funeral pretending to be a birthday party, really, isn't it, right? Were people sort of smirking and laughing into their sleeves?
I don't think people were smirking. It actually was quite a somber moment because it felt like Rishi Sunak's, not quite his resignation speech, but it was clear that he was putting on a great pretense, that he wasn't enjoying himself. It wasn't just that we all knew that he was going to lose the next election, it's that he knew he was going to lose the next election.
There's an interesting question there about when it was that the realisation sunk in to senior Conservatives' heads that this was it.
Stories I talked to who were working for Rishi Sunak at the time say that as soon as he took over, he was pretty cognizant of the fact that he was about to lose the next election. In fact, I'm told that they, around the beginning of the year, did some polling, which they kept internal to themselves at CCHQ, which showed the landslide was going to be even bigger. You know, Labour were going to end up with a 200-seat majority or something just fantastically absurd. One of the reasons for calling the election when they did is so that they just didn't see any improvement. They thought, well, why not just go now?
This was a get it over with
election. Just do it. Just take the pain now. So I think they knew kind of fairly early on into Rishi Sunak's time in office that this was going nowhere. But, you know, there was a really interesting moment. I think actually it came last year during the Tory party conference, and he'd had this pretty good opening stint. The markets had recovered, the bond markets were much calmer. And then he gives this conference speech where you suddenly realise he doesn't know what comes next. It was very odd. It was the one where he managed to cancel HS2, the train line, high-speed train line to Manchester while speaking from a former train station in Manchester. One of the most absurd pieces of politics I think I've ever seen. And we were all there trying to figure out if there was some 4D chess going on. And then we realised, no, they're just not very good at
this. Can we just pause it? Because with Rishi Sunak, there was this amazing talent for the worst sort of symbolism. He just did it over and over again. The Titanic Silverstone, the fact that it was seen and photographed putting petrol in someone else's car and thus proving that he had a much more expensive car hidden away somewhere and he didn't know how to use a debit card. Do you remember that? I mean, the latter part of his political career when he reaches the top is just replete with these awful, awful bits of symbolism. It brings to mind, really, something Steve Richards, the political commentator, famously said, the sort of one of the dons of political commentary, said that accident-prone politicians don't become accident-prone by accident, right? Mm. And so the awful symbolism is like an index of the fact that it's hopeless, that they're in a tailspin.
And I think it showed that he wasn't, as Kieran said, they just weren't good at politics. But maybe I'm being generous with the benefit of hindsight. I'm not sure if it could have turned out any other way. And I would go back even further than Tory party conference last year to the moment that Boris Johnson resigned. And Boris Johnson, if you just think back, I mean, it's remarkable that it's, you know, almost 5 years to the day it was 5 years last week since he came to power on that sort of post-Brexit, get Brexit done wave, had a majority of 80 and looked unassailable. I mean, we all thought, you know what, he's going to be in power for a decade. And then it unraveled. And it unraveled, you know, yes, because of external events with...
Because of you,
no,
Pepper.
Not because of me. External events of you. Like the pandemic and because of, you know, and cost of living.
Can I just say
to
the listeners
so
here, Pepper's been rather modest here, that obviously in breaking Partygate, even if that decline was in some way inevitable, you didn't half accelerate it. I mean, I always say this, but I think for the record, that needs to be said.
I always say when people say you brought down Boris Johnson, no, I didn't. He brought himself down. He was only one, the person that was responsible. But regardless, that moment when it was clear that he wasn't going to be able to survive, he was bunkered down in Downing Street, it sort of opened my eyes up to the fact that, you know, actually anything could happen.
But that's when
election.
The Tory tailspin starts.
They just looked so divided as a party. And one thing we know going back decades over Tory leaders is that, you know, divided parties don't win elections. And to me, that was a really clear moment that things had broken down to such extent it was going to be very difficult for whoever followed to put it together.
Let's briefly mention Kemi Badenoch, who was elected leader after a protracted campaign and contest in November. I remember pitching up at the so-called beauty contest Tory conference in Birmingham. What an odd affair that was. Do you remember when the 5 minutes for which James Cleverly was the leading contender?
It was.
Me and Kieran thought we had it in the bag. We were wrong. Kemi Badenoch was elected. Last thing I read, she was making noises about flat tax.
Sandwiches are not the
kind of rugged go get a lunch option.
Lunches
that's been
for
another
wimps.
Another one of hers. She has a steak for lunch. Hasn't she called for Keir Starmer's resignation already?
She did that silly petition came out. Where do you go from there?
Right. How do you think she's doing on the whole? Hard to tell at the moment.
I think not great. but not as explosively terrible as she might. And look, she's in a difficult position now because the Conservatives obviously were rejected so fully at the last election. And as you know, we've said countless times before, the election result was as much or more about people giving the Tories a kicking and getting them out of power as it was sort of like a resounding endorsement and enthusiasm for Labour. So she was inheriting a really difficult situation politically. But what she has not done, and I've been quite surprised by, is kind of properly look at why things got so bad for the Conservatives and why the country rejected them. You know, the first interview she did when she went on the BBC with Laura Koonsberg, she turned around and she basically dismissed Partygate and suggested that it was an irrelevance, when that's not how we know the vast majority of the country feel.
That's the one where she said that Rachel Reeves saying that she was the first female chancellor didn't really count for anything at all, and Rachel Reeves should shut up. It was very graceless, that.
It was graceless and grating. but what she has tried to do is say, look, we're going to go back to first principles. We're not going to come out with a whole set of policy proposals, which, you know, will be fit for purpose in 5 years' time by the time of the next election. What it looks like now, I mean, unless things go terribly badly for Labour, is that the Conservative Party is so far from government that, you know, a lot could happen in 5 years. And actually, they need to be able to respond to events as they happen, rather than what looks like, what feels like putting off any sort of policy decision for 2 years.
Let's talk about the party of government now, the Labour Party. Kieran, tell us your sort of key moment of the political.
I was trying to think of moments where I was there and something kind of changed in my mind. And I was on a plane. It was a private plane rented by the Labour Party during the election campaign, final day of the election. And Keir Starmer has flown. He's had this slightly crazy final day of the campaign, which started off in Wales. He flew up to Glasgow and did a rally there. And then he flew back down to Birmingham, did a rally there, and then came back down to London. It's a really difficult day reporting on election eve, because your stories are going to come out as people are making their mind up and going to the polling booth. So you've got to reflect like the country's about to change, but you also can't have too many hostages to fortune because things could be drastically different in 24 hours' time. So we were thinking, what do we need to ask Keir Starmer here to really get a sense of what is going on? And mostly he just gave his rote answers that he'd learnt, that he was giving on the stump, that he was giving to us all the way through the campaign. On the way back from Glasgow, his answers changed. He changed. His shoulders relaxed. He started smiling. He came down the plane to talk to us voluntarily. And he suddenly, you could see it in his face, suddenly realised he was about to become Prime Minister. And he started moving like a Prime Minister. And he started talking like a Prime Minister. And he said something quite interesting. He started talking about his cabinet to come. And I suddenly thought, my God, you've never said this before.
Yeah,
and he
yeah.
said, I've told my ministers, who are going to be cabinet ministers, that they need to hit the ground running and they can't have any moment in office having a meeting they could have had in opposition, which was a kind of interesting thing to say at that point. But it was just the way he phrased it. I thought, he's realised this is actually happening. He's now taking on the part of prime minister. And I think it was just quite a revelatory moment for all of us who were on that plane.
And that looks like something you saw that was authentic. It's not like someone said to him, drop your shoulders a bit.
No,
walk
because
over
he wouldn't have done anyway.
Prime,
he wouldn't
prime minister. No, you're sort of seeing the real person there. And interestingly, the fact that he was sort of enthusiastically leaning in.
Yeah.
You read accounts of other prime ministers on the verge of supposed landslide victories in some biographies, and they talk about the fact that, as most normal human beings would, they get a terrible outbreak of self-doubt and nerves and so on. I think Blair doubted that he was going to win a landslide. He wasn't sure. You saw something quite different there.
It was the moment where it was something like, okay, we've played defence. It's worked. My God, we're actually here.
Right, and then that led on, obviously, to Keir Starmer giving his first speech on the steps of Downing Street. Let's hear a bit of that.
If you voted Labour yesterday, we will carry the responsibility of your trust as we rebuild our country. But whether you voted Labour or not, in fact, especially if you did not, I say to you directly, my government will serve you.
Right, and here we are now, quite a long way, literally and metaphorically, from that glad, somewhat confident morning. The government is unpopular, things have been very choppy, pretty much from the advent of its time in power. You know, my script here says, do you think it's been as they expected? That's a really good question, in as much as anyone looking ahead would realise it was choppy. And that was kind of their rhetoric, right? They would say, you know, don't get your expectations up. This is going to be really, really difficult. Did they think it was going to be this difficult?
I think that they hoped it wouldn't be, but that Starmer himself and the people around him knew that there would be lots of challenges. What I don't think they expected was some of their own errors, which made a difficult situation worse. I spent a lot of time in the first 3 months, first 100 days of Starmer's time in office, talking to him, to cabinet ministers, to Labour MPs, to officials, to political aides, to senior civil servants, to write a big piece for The Guardian magazine, which you can still find online if you're interested.
I've read it. I read it.
And sort of the conclusion of most people I spoke to towards the end of that 100-day period was, I mean, they were definitely jittery, right? They felt they'd got off to a good start with Starmer looking prime ministerial, as Kieran said. He went off to NATO, he was on the world stage. He was seen generally to have handled the riots well. They played to his strengths as a former director of public prosecutions. He was looking hardworking. And then things started to get a bit iffy towards the end of the summer. There was this doom and gloom approach to the economy. He was accused of talking
down. That
was
late August, he said, things are going to get worse before they get better. And also, he said he didn't want to put the fear of God into people about the budget. Do you remember him saying that?
And then there was the beginning of the freebies row, which was already out there. There's this old maxim at Westminster that scandals are not exposed, they're simply noticed.
Pause there for a minute on so-called freebie gate, because we talked about Rishi Sunak's talent for awful symbolism. And the reason that freebie gate started to stir during the election campaign, but clearly the reason that landed so heavily and to my mind, lingers on, actually. If you ask a lot of people, ordinary members of the public, about the government, you know, the idea that they sort of gloried in getting free stuff for nothing still lingers on, along with how awkwardly that sits with a government that was telling people it was going to get worse and tighten your belt. And that's the reason for the awful symbolism. Having broken cover in the late summer and said, look, this is going to be really awful and life's going to get even harder, to then find out that tens of thousands of pounds of other people's money is being spent on suits and going to Taylor Swift concerts and his box at Arsenal, even though some of those things have innocent explanations, right, which he tried with the football side of it. Again, the symbolism is just dreadful. It takes no party gate. It takes no explanation because it looks like one rule for them, another rule for you. And once you're in that place, you're in the worst conceivable
place. Yeah, and very specifically, not only were they saying that things will get, you know, things are going to get worse, they actually decided and announced earlier in the summer to cut the winter fuel allowance.
I still think that's inexplicable.
The
do you?
Poorest pensioners. I think people right at the top of government that I speak to concede that they got that announcement wrong. That's not to say that they're saying that they shouldn't have done it, but it's that they recognise that by announcing it at the beginning of the summer and then letting this sore fester for 6 weeks until they put in place any or announce any sort of mitigations, that they had lost control of the narrative completely on it.
The budget, it seemed to me, highlighted constantly changing narrative between optimism and pessimism. That's what I couldn't keep up with. At the end of the summer, it was pessimism, right? So you get this sort of doom and gloom narrative, and then they scare themselves. The news starts to become, well, this is going to adversely affect the economy. You know, what about consumer confidence and how businesses feel and all of that? So that then rears its head. So by the time we all get to Liverpool for the Labour Party conference, they're then really going out of their way to say, no, it's not quite as bad as you think, and we are going to sound optimistic now. And that was the narrative. That was maintained in the budget, actually. Let's remember that. So the way they wanted to sell it was investment, right? So this isn't the doom and gloom budget, and actually we are going to borrow to invest. And then since then, the talk's been, we're going to ask all the departments to come up with 5% cuts, and we're back to doom and gloom. So the graph just constantly goes up and down, and it's very hard to know what it is they want us to think.
People always blame the comms on this stuff when often it's the policy that's the problem. But actually, I do think comms is a bit of a problem here. But I was having lunch with the Labour MP, and one of their main topics of conversation was, in the budget, what Rachel Reeves asked us all to do was pay more tax to try and fix the public state. But then the narrative since then is not, oh, good, we've got some more money for the NHS. This is going to help fix this or that problem. It's exactly as you said, John. It's, oh, well, we haven't actually got much more money for the public sector. Now, part of the reason for that, I think, is because it's literally true. So a lot of that extra money is going to pay for things that have previously been announced but not actually funded. And that's the problem Labour has got. They can't announce nice, shiny new things because they're having to fund the things that have previously been announced. But it doesn't take a great amount of political skill to be able to find one or two things that you can pull out and say, this is what your money's going
to. You have to do that.
Is this debate that's going on inside Downing Street, which I was talking to somebody, an aide there the other day, about delivery and narrative. And they've done this, they've sort of gone to and fro in thinking that this government needs to be able to prove by the time of the next election that they've delivered on really quite tangible things. So the migration has come down. It's easier to get a hip operation.
Your kids in their 20s can get a house.
And that you have more money, you know, living standards, you've got more money in your pocket.
Sure.
And if you can deliver on those very material, tangible differences, then you can show that things have changed. The issue is, though, is that they, for a while, didn't think that they needed to tell that story. They thought that the public had kind of had enough of big promises, had enough of any promises, wouldn't believe them even if they made them, and that they just needed to show rather than to tell. And the conclusion this individual told me the other day that they've come to is that that was actually wrong, and that you can't just show, you need to tell, you need the story around it.
I am pulling my incredulous face at this point. Because if you're a politician and you don't understand the importance of stories, then I don't know what you're doing in politics. It makes me quite cross that. It really, really does. That's what politics is all about. The idea that storytelling or so-called delivery are mutually exclusive is laughable. Clearly you have to deliver, but you need a story along with it, right? Gordon Brown's a good example of this when he was in government. It's just numbers and stats.
Yeah.
It's 10,000 of this, 75% of that, 3 of that and 5 of those.
So
and
looking
it doesn't
at
speak
the
to
senior
people.
Labour politicians that are around at the moment, I mean, you clearly don't think that Keir Starmer is capable of delivering that sort of story. Who do you look at?
It's a cliché answer,
Lisa,
which is Angela Rayner.
Yeah. But is there anybody else that you kind of think can help tell that story?
I think there's a general deficit of that quality in government. Mm-hmm. And this applies across politics. I think the talent pool has dried up somewhat because politics is such a nasty and arduous business. And although I ended up being no fan of Tony Blair at all, by comparison, he was a political wizard, wasn't he? He could really tell stories, right? And I think one of the reasons we'll come on to talk about reform in a moment that Nigel Farage is making so much headway is he can tell stories. And he sort of embodies stories. You almost don't have to hear it. It's all there to start with. And it's a real problem. Should we talk about reform now and really cheer ourselves up? Right, it's my moment of the year now. So we travelled around the country a lot during the election campaign. And I had this sense right from the start, really, that the rise of Reform UK, to give them their full title, was inescapable. So you'd go off to do another story, you know. It might be Ian Duncan Smith and Faiza Shaheen in out of London. It might be the Green Party somewhere or other. Or you might be chasing what you thought was a Labour Party story, and you just constantly meet every sort of fourth or fifth person would talk reasonably passionately and in an interested way about reform and where they were doing. And I suppose when all of this came into the sharpest relief was when we went to Boston in Lincolnshire, which was a Reform UK target seat. We did what we always do, really, and hung around the town and talked to people. But also, we went to this quite strange event in a little church hall in a village on the outskirts of Boston, where the former Reform leader, Richard Tice, was there to speak. And Anne Widdecombe, the erstwhile Strictly Come Dancing contestant, pitched up in a Reform-branded taxi. It was a very, very surreal day all round, really. And throughout that experience, really, you had a sense that these politicians were full of vim and thought their moment was coming. I mean, arguably, it's their moment has been coming since 2016. But then also just members of the public. Even the ones who said, I'm not, because they could smell Guardian on you, I'll be honest, you know. They said, well, I'm not going to tell you, I'm going to vote. And it was pretty obvious what they meant. Let's hear a bit of me interviewing Richard Tice.
The point about Brexit is you're in control of your own destiny. So that when you make mistakes, you can say, actually, these people have messed it up, the Conservative Party. People in Reform understand Brexit. Yeah. They're going to sort it out, get them into Parliament, shout from the rooftops. People who know what they're talking about, we can help sort it out. This is a journey, okay? And we're on that journey. We will be the opposition that takes on the Labour Party in 28-29.
They were this unavoidable thing that kept popping up. You can tell he was absolutely full of confidence, and so it proved. He won that seat. He became one of Reform's five MPs. How significant do you think was that? And let's not forget, because of our ridiculous electoral system, they got five MPs. But remind me what proportion of the vote they got. It wasn't insignificant.
It's like 14%.
Okay. Since the election, there are quite a few polls, the majority now, show us that we may be moving to a sort of European-style polity, that's the posh word, whereby the party of the hard right, if you want to call them that, is routinely on 20%. And actually, the two main parties now are polling in the mid-20s, which is sort of historically unprecedented, it is said, right? So Reform really are here to eat the main party's dinner. That's the way that they'd like us to see them. This is significant stuff, Pippa, isn't it?
It is. And I think initially, and probably still now, Nigel Farage and his party were absolutely thrilled to win seats in Parliament. I mean, Farage had tried seven times before and failed, hasn't he? So on a personal level, winning Clacton and being able to stand up on those green benches, I'm sure meant a huge amount to him. But it was important for them for two main reasons. One, because it gives them a platform that they previously didn't have, both inside the Commons and then all the sort of, you know, the broadcast media that comes attached with that, although he obviously has his own show on GB News as well. Also, the legitimacy it lends in voters' mind to a party that has a presence in the House of Commons. However, I think that they'll realise that actually it's a bit of a problem, because Reform, to do well, need to present themselves as the insurgents. And if they have one foot in establishment politics, you know, they're there in the corridors of power, and it's very hard for them to be sort of the freewheeling insurgents, or rather, it is harder than it would be if they were entirely outside of Westminster. So I think they're going to have to watch that.
There's two things possibly that could stand in Reform's way of kind of bringing the insurgent wave that they talk about. One is Nigel Farage, when I used to cover him back in 2010 to 2015, was absolutely brilliant at knowing where the line was. So every so often, although he did his right-wing populism stuff and his, you know, anti-immigration stuff, he would know exactly when British voters thought, oh, so-and-so's gone too far. And he had this really good sense of where the British public was in terms of what's fair and what's not, and what's Sebel and what's not Sebel. I think that's slightly gone. I've noticed recently he's much more willing to lean into quite American style.
Hence my comment about outrage.
It is much darker view of the world. And I don't think that that is shared by most British voters. And I think there is a risk for him here that he gets too close to his American buddies. The other thing, let me just, on the Musk point, and I saw this covering American politics for 4 years, this is going to test British institutions. If Elon Musk wants to donate megabucks to Reform UK, there are rules against him doing so. Foreigners aren't supposed to be able to do that. Now, he says, oh, well, it's fine. I can just do it through, you know, X UK's arm. But the Electoral Commission can say, look, we don't think that that money is from X UK. We think that the original source of that money is Elon Musk, for which there will be plenty of evidence. Is the Electoral Commission going to be strong enough stand up and say,
that's the question.
Sorry, you cannot bring this money into the UK. That is clearly foreign interference. John, you want to go to an advert break now.
I know,
but I'm not going to let you.
Go on.
I'm going to hijack this podcast.
Are you?
Completely. Yeah.
Go on.
Regular listeners will know that sometimes I like to surprise Pippa by giving her quizzes about politically apt quotes. Well, to celebrate the end of the year, I'm going to turn to your specialist subject.
Oh, blimey, me. Go on.
Oh, good. Spotlight on him. Brilliant. Not me for once.
Music.
Okay.
All right. So I've created a playlist of songs which are featured in British or American politics over the past year.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Okay.
Right. First question. You ready for this? This song, I'm going to take this away. Stop looking at my script. The answer, the political connection is really obvious. But what I want to know in this clip is, who is it who's blasting it out of their makeshift sound system? All right, let's hear it.
It might still be hard when you look at your bank balance. But this hard-earned economic stability was only ever meant to be the beginning. The question now is how and who do you trust to turn that foundation into a secure future?
All right, so you could hear a song in the background there of Rishi Sunak in the rain.
Quite confident about that one.
Yeah. All right, come on then. You know what the song is, Pippa? You know what the song is.
It's D-Ream's Things Can Only Get Better.
And who is playing it?
A fella called Steve Bray. It's the bane of all our lives. Whenever you pitch up to Downing Street or party conferences, I don't know how he manages to connect it to the electricity supply, because it's by no means a little Bluetooth speaker, is it, that he bought
it's
in
massive,
bought in
kind
curries.
Of like dustbin
he
style.
He has a massive sound system.
And wasn't it a moment that the police didn't stop him? They let him go on for ages and ages.
That was as much as the rain on the suit watching that on TV.
The fact sapping that, away, isn't
the
it?
The fact that the Titanic, the New Labour Blair anthem was blasting away, I thought he was sunk.
It was quite something.
He was
quite
sunk.
All right. Okay, next one. What is the political connection here? And a bonus point if you can name the choir that is singing it.
When we're brought into this world, we only have each other. Every second we have left is worth a thousand others. Our house isn't a home until we learn to love each other. It's not about what we have left.
Do you know what it is?
I never want to hear it again, Kira. I make that clear.
Okay, Pippa.
You will be disappointing Sir Ed Davey, the leader of the Liberal Democrats.
Is that his record?
Because he has joined up with the Carers Choir. Do I get a bonus point for this?
Yes.
To create Very a Christmas good. Number one. It well, is. It's not Christmas number one. It's Christmas number 572 or something. But to raise money for carers. And do I get an extra point? Bath Philharmonic Orchestra.
Very good.
Ed Davey doesn't sing much in it.
Who needs Elvis, the Beatles and everyone else? Go and buy that record.
The agreement for us playing the record was that you would say something like that, John.
Yes, there we go.
You're going to clip that now, aren't they?
Right, okay, we can't play this one, but we've had to be creative. We were told this year that Kamala Harris is brat, but which pop singer did this
refer
this. To?
I
and
know
can you name any one of her songs? All right, John, go.
I can't name any Charlie XCX songs because I'm old, but okay. it's Charlie XCX.
Yeah.
There you go.
Can so you name any of her songs? I'd also know that it's her. Those songs get played quite regularly in my house, given I've got two teenagers and a 10-year-old, but I don't know the names of any of them, I'm afraid. Right. My kids could, but I can't.
Very good.
Our producer down the earphones is saying she saw her live. So there we go. That's
well done, Frankie.
The voice of
Let's
you,
ask her.
Frankie Toby.
It's our 15-year-old producer.
All right, two more. Last one of a politician. I've got one question about this. What the hell is going on here?
I only got that at the end when the beat hit.
When it went,
I can't remember the name of the DJ, but that is when Angela Rayner went to Ibiza.
Very
and
amazing.
Was in the DJ box.
Amazing.
And was giving it large.
Yes.
Amazing.
And the song is, of course, Somebody That I Used to Know by Goche. It was the drop. That
of course,
of,
obviously. That was on the tip of my tongue.
I quite like the fact we got a ravey Deputy Prime Minister. I'm into that.
Definitely. Yeah.
All right. Talking about ravey people. Listen to this. Tell me who's singing.
I know what the song is.
Yeah. All right, Pippa's not allowed to answer this. John, there is one. I would say there's a dominant voice.
So that's Mr. Brightside by the Killers, the Las Vegas spawned indie group fronted by Brandon Flowers. Is that when you did that with Andy Burnham? Is that you?
Oh God, no, it was not.
You've done karaoke with Andy Burnham
and Andy Rayner. Yeah,
was that not you?
The three of us. No, we sang. I think we sang the Proclaimers. Actually,
that was, however, beneath the dulcet tones of one of the FT's political correspondents. Yeah. That was Pippa Grira.
It was you.
Singing Mr. Brightside.
Well, that means
on
that
stage.
2 points for me.
Who was that with?
Jim Pickard.
When was that?
The FT. That was this.
Oh, this is terrible. I'm far too into Pippa,
it. I've got a video of it.
Can I just say
you're anybody needs to
maybe
see
a few sheets to the wind, given your...
Absolutely not. I reject your insomnia. That. My lawyers will be in touch.
Not insomnia. Your amnesia. Your amnesia about this occasion.
Remember doing it.
Did I do that?
It's just because I'm a karaoke fan, and I'm afraid that party conference is one of the few places that I'm allowed to kind of
phone up Jim Pickard the next day. Come, was I all right? Was I embarrassing?
I can testify, Pippa. I've done karaoke with Pippa. She has a fantastic voice. It's
I can't
Jim
hear myself. Who
is ruining that
song? Absolutely, it's Jim all Jim's Pickard. Fault.
Well, look, I'm delighted to tell Politics Weekly listeners. By the way, that was fantastic. I wasn't expecting you to do so well. I'm delighted to tell Politics Weekly listeners that all of these songs and more that all have political connections are on a playlist.
Amazing.
Entitled Politics Weekly Playlist of the Year on Spotify. And I'm going to tweet that after this episode, when this episode
Hopefully
goes
not
up.
My version of Mr. Brightside.
No, I don't think that is on Spotify, unfortunately. But anybody who can name all the political connections, get in touch with me on Twitter and you will get my undying respect.
You get to do karaoke with Pippa.
Yeah, so that's the prize.
An invitation
Absolutely.
To the next karaoke
well up
session.
For that.
But that segues nicely into one more surprise that I've got for the two of you. Because it's Christmas, I've popped to the local petrol station and I've picked you each up a Christmas gift.
Bloody hell.
To mark the end of what is a momentous, what was a momentous year in British politics. Can we do John first?
Frankie, our producer, has just walked into the room with a massive yellow bag.
I'm going to well up. It's the Davey record.
Yes!
It is a limited edition. Do you know what, John? They printed that for you specially. There were no physical copies of that song. And the Liberal Democrats agreed to publish that for you.
Declare it in your gifts and hospitality. Yeah. John, you told us that Christmas week was going to stretch. It will stretch no more.
You cannot be hammering this.
Love is enough.
Goodwill to all people and lacrimosity all round. That's what I say.
I appear to have an absolutely massive present
Yeah, Pippa,
here.
This one is not just from me, I should say. This is from the entire of the Guardian political team, who wanted to get you this to remember the year that we've just had, which I think can be something.
Come on, Pippa,
okay,
open it
I'm
up.
Not sure whether I should be loudly. Grateful or rude about this, because I know what my team are like, and let's say there's a lack of respect, shall we say, for my
This is a very respectful present, I will say. It's very
okay,
respectful.
Okay, let's go.
Can I just describe to people listening, so this is a vast package.
It's an absolutely enormous package. Partially
huge rectangle.
Because
lovingly wrapped. Pippa's seen whatever it is already. Come on, let's see. Big
this
reveal.
This is... Reveal. The front page of The Guardian from Friday, 5th July, 2024. Labour landslide. A picture of Keir Starmer and his wife, Victoria. And a story written by me and two of the team, Jessica and Rowena. Thank you so much, Kieran and the team. That is going on there. Too big for my bathroom wall. It's going to be on the office wall.
Allude to Oscar Wilde here. You should put that in your attic. You know what I mean by that.
Frankie, come back in. Listeners won't necessarily know this, but Frankie is completely dedicated to politics.
I agree.
But that is not her first love in life. Her first love in life is food. So I've found a couple of very small things that hopefully marry your two great loves in life.
Come on, let's hear it. We have to hear the tearing noises. That's it. That's good.
Right. Thank you very much.
Amazing.
What have we got? Oh!
What have you got?
I have got House of Commons luxury artisan chocolate medallions.
Yeah, they are dairy free.
Suffragette cookbook.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. And we should also say, as well as a thank you to you, a huge thank you to Maz, our other editor producer, who is currently on maternity leave, having given birth to her second child just a few weeks ago. So, Maz, if you're listening, we all love you.
Merry
Congratulations
Christmas.
And happy Christmas.
Absolutely.
Within sight of Big Ben, that birth happened.
It did.
Very on brand Politics Week in the UK.
In the hospital, we should say, you know, across the River St Thomas's,
Awards didn't break on Westminster Bridge.
She
or something.
Didn't like deliberately
no,
like head towards
happen.
Parliament.
No, but the photo we were all sent very visibly at the Palace of Westminster in the background, which I thought was very good.
Very lovely.
Right, let's pause here for a minute among all this merriment. When we come back, we'll be answering your questions about 2024 and what the hell might happen next year.
Du träumst davon, dem Alltag zu entfliehen oder die Welt zu bereisen? Das bedeutet wahrscheinlich, dass du dir ein unabhängiges Leben wünschst. Investieren für deine Zukunft kann dir dabei helfen. Mit iShares ETFs kann jeder anfangen, kleine, regelmäßige Beträge zu investieren. Und das schon ab einem Euro. So kannst du deine Zukunftsziele erreichen, ohne einen Berg von Papierkram zu bewältigen. Mehr Zeit zum Träumen. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fange noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. In advance of this episode of Politics Weekly UK, we went on a few social media platforms. The one we mostly favour now is Blue Sky. Can we just make that clear? There was a reasonable level of engagement. We got a few suggested questions back, and we're now going to attempt to answer them. Here's question one from KingWolf84. Good name. Why is the media obsessed with Reform UK when the Greens and Lib Dems have been more successful?
Well, I think Kieran needs to start because I've just shoved a leprechaun in my mouth and obviously far too polite to talk with my mouth full.
Well, the answer is fairly straightforward, which is exactly what you were saying before, John, which is the current polls put Reform, some of them put Reform UK top. So yeah, the Greens and the Lib Dems did do very well. But Reform UK at the moment, and I think this is exactly what you were picking up on the ground, is just surging in a way that even UKIP didn't when they existed, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's what the polls are telling us. And we're journalists and we kind of have to
follow the story. But also, I have to say, I do think we should just very quickly add that if you were to sort of, you know, have a scale balancing out the political leanings of newspapers in this country, more of them lean to the right than to the left. So there is possibly more of an appetite in the editorial rooms of those newspapers to look into exactly what's going on inside Reform, with all the glamour, if you like, of the links with Donald Trump and the US presidency.
Yeah.
Than there is to some of the other parties that are much more established.
I think there still is an overlooked story about the Lib Dems and Greens, right? And the Lib Dems in particular, dare I say, because the sort of hard right post-Brexit turn in conservatism has definitely alienated places we thought and people we thought of as core Tory voters and old Tory heartlands. And a big story in the election was what happened in Guildford and Surrey Heath. Aldershot Labour took just over the border in Hampshire. And I'm fascinated by that story.
And it will continue to be a story as well.
It's a really fascinating story.
If Kemi Badenoch does, as currently looks like she will, pitch to the right to try and take on Reform on the Tories' right flank, where do those voters go?
Yeah. Just to reassure you, KingWolf84, for the ensuing 12 months, I will carry on writing about the revolt against the Tories in the shires and suburbs and how the Tory party, and in some cases the Greens, actually. There's another question from Helen Louise, 1973. How worried should we be about Reform? I am particularly worried about their rise in Wales, my home country. Good question, because the Welsh elections, which I think are due
2026,
they're really getting ready for those Reform, and they think they could be the opposition to a rather fragile Labour regime in Wales. Generally in the UK, she asks, what does Starmer need to do to counter the rise of populism? Doctoral theses have been written about less. And how worried should we be about Elon Musk? What a huge range of questions.
Yeah.
As we've said already, Reform is insurgent. It's on the up. The Musk factor cannot be underestimated. And Starmer has yet to come up with a convincing answer. That's my brisk response.
Well, and as you say, we've discussed this, but with Wales in particular, Nigel Farage launched the Reform UK general election manifesto in the Valleys in Wales and South Wales. They have long seen it as a potential target. Obviously, the Senedd elections in 2026, spring 26, will be the first sort of, you know, big scale test of that. And given the electoral system in Wales is not first past the post, you could see a situation where Reform is unlikely probably to, you know, to take the Senedd, but could form a sizable minority. We've also got, before that, we should just say, the May elections this year coming.
Some of them, there's news about the government cancelling some of them because of local government reform.
Yeah, we'll be keeping our eyes on reform for those as well. They're not the most important set of elections for Labour. That comes the following year. But nevertheless, it will be interesting to see how reform play up against the Conservatives and Labour in some of the seats that are up for the vote.
Point is there that unlike UKIP, they are really concentrating on getting their act together in grassroots politics.
Because they want people to see them as more professional.
Correct, yeah.
I mean, we saw during the election campaign, and I'm sure a lot of people were put off voting for them because there was lots of candidates or people associated with the party that ended up having to be kicked out of Reform UK for making racist remarks or inappropriate remarks past.
Do you answer the Musk question specifically?
Do you know what? I want to answer a different part of the question, which is what does Starmer need to do to counter the rise of populism?
Well, you do that and ignore my attempt to direct the conversation, Kieran.
What does Starmer need to do to counter the rise of populism? And the reason I pick up on this is because I think it's going to be the most interesting thing. I think the most interesting political question of the next 4 years. And it is kind of summarized in an essay that's kind of done the rounds in Westminster and elsewhere, which is about the death of deliverism by Deepak Bhargava.
Yes, a fashionable subject.
Very fashionable subject. It's what a lot of people in Westminster are talking about. Can you essentially stop the populist right by fixing potholes? Morgan McSweeney thinks you can. He helped defeat the far right in Barking years and years ago by doing exactly that.
They were a disorganized rabble by comparison.
Right, exactly. This is going to be the ultimate test of, okay, we've got NHS waiting lists down, we've fixed some schools, the roads are now working, people aren't all out on strike. The country is not fundamentally broken in the way that it seemed to be a few years ago. Is that enough to keep reform at bay? This is the great gamble, I think, of the Labour Party over the next few years. Can they deliver their way to another election win? Are their political weaknesses going to be too much in the end?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me, this echoes something we said earlier, that delivery is necessary but not sufficient, and the storytelling vacuum is very, very relevant here. Mm-hmm. I get the consolation prize then. How worried should we be about Elon Musk? There's a very easy answer to that question if you use X, which is just click the For You feed. That's what you need to do.
Never do it.
Come out of your following feed and click For You. And once you do that, you get the sense of this politics very much outside the world in which most politicians move, which is pretty awful and ugly and nasty very often. But again, does feel like it has this momentum behind it. And it sits not only in politics, but in culture. It's sort of rooted in people's everyday lives more. And once you've done that and you know who owns the platform and you know how much money he's got to throw around, you do start to feel anxious. You get a sort of sudden moment of clarity. Don't do that over Christmas, folks. Allow yourself a good time.
Season of goodwill and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Wait till early January. Right, let's go to question three from Katharina24, who's on Blue Sky. Hats off to you in relation to my Musk comments. She says, this newish government hasn't been short of criticism or advice from all quarters. I'd like to know which of their policies so far do you think will have the most positive impact and why? So, again, contrary to my Eeyore-ish sceptical reputation. I am really interested in what Bridget Phillipson is doing at the Department for Education, and both in terms of policy, but also the kind of big picture rhetoric. Because she's talked about schools becoming more inclusive, dialing down old-fashioned discipline. It's been a big story in the news lately. There's a huge question about the special needs system and how broken down it is, and reforming it and so on. But I think in general, it seems to me, she wants to move away from the sort of grad grindian attainment is everything sort of model that Michael Gove introduced to state education and do something different, right? And I find that really interesting as the thing to follow. It's early doors yet. Very little of this stuff has landed. I think her main thing at the moment is breakfast clubs, which are going to be a very welcome innovation. But I think of the ministers in the cabinet, she is among the most interesting. Right, Kieran, do you want to pick which of their policies so far you think will have the most positive impact and why?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it is building. It is planning and house building.
You write quite a lot about that, don't you?
I do. I'm really interested in it for a bunch of reasons. I mean, one is personal. My dad worked in social housing for his entire career and is very, very passionate about it. And I've always kind of grown up with that argument in the house. But I think more than that, it feeds into so many other things. Andy Burnham's very interesting on this. He has this policy in Manchester called Housing First.
He does.
Because the theory is that without a house, you don't you're not able to do anything else. Without security of somewhere decent to live, you can't, you know, get a decent job. You can't participate in the economy properly. You know, your health outcomes are going to be that much worse. You are a burden on the state in so many other ways if you don't have this one fundamental thing. So for that, for all those reasons, it's important. Also, as an economic bit of financial juice into the economy, getting house building going is a good idea. Also, just generally beyond houses, you know, we have invested in our capital infrastructure in this country so little over the last few years that our productivity is 20% worse than many of our European competitors. And I think one of the most interesting decisions that Rachel Reeves made in the budget was, well, first of all, to change the fiscal rules to allow her to borrow more. And second of all, to borrow more specifically for spending on capital. And secondly, to say, look, in the spending review, she was reallocating money from day-to-day department running of departments to capital spending. So that's, you know, building roads and building schools and investing in machinery and MRI scanners and things like that. Now, for years, we've had exactly the opposite going on because it's very easy to cut capital spending when you're being asked for savings by the Treasury because people don't often notice a school not getting repaired or a hospital not getting built. But this government says, and let's see if it's serious about it, they're not going to let that happen anymore. They're going to keep capital spending high. Now, if they can couple that with serious planning reform and serious, and you mentioned this before, serious investment in social housing, I think that could actually be quite revolutionary.
Mm. Right, Pippa.
So I'm going to ask this question slightly differently. I'm also going to have two answers. So the first answer is actually not what I regard as Labour's successes so far, but what the public regards. And the policy, can you guess it? The policy that they've announced so far that has been both most popular and has had the highest cut through. Can you guess what it might be?
Renationalising the railways.
Mm-mm.
The deporting illegal immigrants.
Nope.
Switching the big screen off at Euston Station.
Yes, that was it. No. Actually, this isn't probably very surprising. You won't be surprised when I tell you, because underpinning everything that this government needs to do is the economy, and not just sort of the economy in a way that isn't relatable, you know, talking about growth, talking about GDP compared to other countries, but talking about living standards and the amount of money in people's pockets. The most popular policy was their decision to confirm at the budget that the minimum wage would go up to £12.21 an hour from April. That's 3.5 million workers. There are others which are also popular, the work that they've done on sewage, keeping the triple lock on pension, renters' rights, employment rights, both popular and has cut through. So, you know, there's plenty there that Labour is doing that is cutting through that people are paying attention to. So I think we're quite prone to sort of talk about the things which people don't like. And then I would just very quickly add one, because it's quite personal to me, is that I don't think that you can improve the standing of the British political system and specifically politicians from across the board unless you finally sort out the ethics regime. And it's only one small part of the picture, but Labour has already started, actually quite quietly, below the radar, making changes like having much stricter requirements for what second jobs MPs can do, giving the Prime Minister's ethics advisor the independence to start their own inquiries. Not all the way there yet. The Prime Minister will still get the final say. And they're going to set up this ethics board, which acts as sort of an umbrella for all the very many disparate ethics bodies that there currently are. And I think that that will go some way to improving the system. And that can only be a good thing.
The only way is ethics.
Yay! Yay! Boom, boom.
Cheers. And on that seasonal note of humour, we will leave it. Thank you so much for joining us, Kieran and Pippa.
Thanks, John.
Thanks so much for having us. Happy Christmas.
It's been nice to be here. This year, for The Guardian and Observer's annual charity appeal, we're asking for your support to help individuals whose lives have been turned upside down as a result of conflict. We're partnering with War Child and MSF to help support individuals impacted by the horrific effects of war, from emergency aid to psychological support. Plus, we've also teamed up with Parallel Histories, who help schools teach children about contested conflicts. If you can, please donate now at theguardian.com/donate24. Thanks for listening. This is our last episode of 2024, a year I'm very pleased to see the back of. I hope you managed to have a great Christmas break and New Year. Politics Weekly Westminster with Pippa and Kieran will be back in the new year on Monday the 6th of January, and I'll be back on the 9th. I say this every week, but if you've liked our podcast over the last year, please do consider leaving us a review. It really makes a difference. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Happy Christmas. And I hope you have a brilliant new year.
This is The Guardian.
träumst davon, dem Alltag zu entfliehen oder die Welt zu bereisen? Das bedeutet wahrscheinlich, dass du dir ein unabhängiges Leben wünschst. Investieren für deine Zukunft kann dir dabei helfen. Mit iShares ETFs kann jeder anfangen, kleine, regelmäßige Beträge zu investieren. Und das schon ab einem Euro. So kannst du deine Zukunftsziele erreichen, ohne einen Berg von Papierkram zu bewältigen. Mehr Zeit zum Träumen. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fange noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.